Good morning. Welcome, everyone. I'm Martina McGrath. I'm a transplant nephrologist at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, and I'm also an attending nephrologist at the VA Boston Healthcare System. I'm deputy editor of NephSAP, and I am delighted today to be joined by two of our very illustrious guest editors for our upcoming CKD issue. I'd like to introduce Dr. Adira Levin, who is a professor of medicine and head of the Division of Nephrology at University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. She is executive director of BC Renal, who's responsible for overseeing the care of people living with kidney disease in the very large province of British Columbia, but also is a very active clinician, researcher with over 600 peer-reviewed publications, multiple teaching awards, and sits on many guideline groups, including KDIGO and KDOQI. Welcome, Dr. Levin.
Thank you.
I also have Dr. Stevens with us today, who is a consultant nephrologist and medical examiner and chair of the Southeast Clinical Senate. He has been working in the NHS across a variety of clinical leadership positions since the 1990s, and also is a very active clinical researcher. He is a former president of the British Renal Society and has been an advisor to the UK government in terms of management of kidney disease, EGFR reporting, and has been chair of several of the NICE guideline committees. Also has chaired several of KDIGO committees, including the recent clinical practice guideline, which is updated on the evaluation and management of chronic kidney disease. So a very warm welcome to you both, and thank you for taking the time to chat with us this morning. Having read your really interesting editorial, I wanted to ask you both maybe a little bit what you think. It feels like we're entering into something of a golden age of nephrology, where we have a lot of clinical trials and a little bit more data to work with. What are your thoughts on the changing landscape of CKD management?
The purpose of calling it coming of age is really just that, in that for years and years and years, we've just had observational data to guide what we do. And we're now in an era where we've got multiple trials, as you indicated, most of them led by Adira. And the outcomes that we're getting from these trials are fantastic for chronic kidney disease. And that's really the first time we've been able to say things like that.
And maybe I'll just expand on that. And to your point, Dr. McGrath, the time to offer people hope for delaying progression of kidney disease and addressing some of the very dire complications of cardiovascular disease in those people is what we can now offer. Whereas before, what we could do is a smooth transition to dialysis or transplantation. That was our great trick up our sleeve. And now we can say, and what is the new golden age, is that we have multiple medications that seem to be effective in multiple different populations that really attenuate the progression of kidney disease, which is giving people a hope that they didn't have before. And that's without the disease-specific medications for the known glomerulonephritides and even some of the vasculitides that we were previously not able to offer anything truly disease-modifying. So I think that's the excitement, and that's the, as Paul says, that's the coming of age part.
You know, to your point in terms of the practicing clinicians who are much of our audience really for this issue, where do you see those practice changings intervening? Should we be focusing on nephrologists? Do we need to go back to primary care doctors as well? It feels like there's so many messages to get to so many people.
Yes, again, that's a really good question, because really where we should be aiming for is as early in the disease pathway as possible. If we can't get prevention, then we need intervention as early as we can, because the earlier we intervene, the less the progression, the less the complication, the better the outcome, and the better it is for patients, and not just patients, their families as well. The who is tricky, and you'll know from data from your own data system that the people who are eligible for interventions and who are eligible to receive them in terms of resource don't necessarily get them. So that's where we need to really start getting into the weeds a little bit. So it's the implementation science again, as I think we mentioned in the editorial.
And I, you know, I'm just again, because this is a conversation, it's worthwhile recognizing that many people don't get diagnosed early. So who should be treated? Everyone who sees the patient. I think it's our collective responsibility as a health, as people working in a healthcare system, that once one identifies kidney disease and can, if possible, establish cause, then early intervention is the key. And I think that we don't want to miss the opportunity to make accurate diagnoses. So that we also emphasize in the editorial about, CKD is not a disease. It is a statement about a functioning of an organ or a set of organs. So it does have a cause, and where possible or practical, one should get figure out what that cause is. However, whatever it is, it seems with all the studies that irrespective of cause, these newer medications are highly effective. I think that's an important message.
I think one of the points that you made in your editorial was about the use of risk prediction tools to stratify patients simply beyond measures of GFR. Can I ask you, Dr. Levin, could you talk about that a little bit in terms of the data and where we are with that?
So people with kidney disease, as everyone I hope knows, have risks for multiple events. The risk equations that are most well validated in largest groups of patients are for our kidney outcome, which is kidney failure. And so people are really interested in whether or not they're going to end up on dialysis in the next 2 to 5 years or require a transplant in the next 2 to 5 years. And so one of the most highly validated equations is the KFRE, the kidney failure risk equation. And so we promote the use of validated risk prediction equations to estimate individual risk because the heat maps are population risks. And I think that that's a nuance that perhaps has not been really embraced by the nephrology community, let alone in other individuals, and perhaps has been perpetuated by the conversation about age. That being said, these risk prediction equations help us to talk to patients to alleviate or anxiety or help with planning. There are other equations that are being validated or have been validated to predict other events like cardiovascular disease, et cetera. So again, in the guideline, we suggest using in your region a validated risk prediction equation for the event of interest to you and to the patient. And I think that's important. There's much more to life than being on or off dialysis. Having an MI, getting atrial fibrillation, dying, getting acute kidney injury, going to the hospital. These are all important events that impact the patient, their family, and the healthcare system. So the more precise we can be with an individual about what we're trying to prevent, and these risk prediction equations give you some of those probabilities. As you know, there's a whole science in how we best communicate with patients about these. I don't know what 30% risk at 2 years means exactly to different people. So how we talk to people is important. I think these risk prediction equations really try and personalize our approach. So it's not just, bald numbers facing people, because a 65-year-old female with lupus has a very different risk of events than an 83-year-old man with cardiac disease. And so we need to prorate our conversations, decide on our medicines and our testing and everything else based on individual risks using these validated equations. And thankfully, there are more and more of them, very well validated in multiple populations around the world with and without kidney disease. So I think we're also in a golden age of that, of the mathematical approach, if you will.
And I guess, that kind of segues a little bit into another point that you emphasized in your editorial. I was really interested in this idea of like a given GFR at a young age, and we see these young people with mild reductions in GFR, and maybe we don't worry about them too much. But then when we look at population studies and we see their lifetime event rates incredibly high, trying to get at that kind of risk and that, to your point as well, Paul, intervene early on those people to prevent these things from happening.
Yeah, and that's part of the reason why we advocate this whole life approach. And as you say, your priorities and how you approach the patient in front of you are going to change dependent not just on cause, but clearly age comes into it in terms of the priority for treatment. For example, with SGLT2 inhibitors, a 90-year-old with the same level of GFR as a 30-year-old maybe lower priority to receive SGLT2 inhibitors. And that's common sense, but sometimes common sense does go out the window. So we're really keen that people individualize their approach, that they use the big data to know what happens in populations, but then treat the person in front of you and use the evidence.
And to that point, I think, talking about those patients with lesser reductions in GFR and lower levels of albuminuria, that is, something that's recommended in the new KDIGO guideline in terms of using SGLT2 inhibitors in those patients. Can you talk about that a little bit as well, please?
So I'm going to defer to Adira for that because.
Well, they're our trials, and I've been pleased to be a part of the steering committee of some of them. But the whole notion, your reduction in risk with SGLT2s is proportional to the risk of the event that you had. And so if one looks at the totality of the SGLT2 trials, everyone benefits to different degrees depending on your underlying baseline risk. And there has been in the nephrology world a little bit of conversation, as always, around, well, maybe it's not as good if you have lower protein. Perhaps because your risk of an event when you have low protein is much lower. So you're not going to show in a small short-term trial a major reduction. However, in the heart trials and the diabetes trials that did include people with higher GFRs and no proteinuria, there is a reduction in onset to new proteinuria. Reduction in slope of GFR, but more, maybe more importantly, cardiovascular risk reduction. And so, what we try and emphasize in the nuancing of both the recommendation number and letter and the wording is that SGLT2 inhibitors are good for anyone with heart failure, anyone with diabetes, irrespective of proteinuria and GFR. And if you're trying to reduce progression of kidney disease in someone with low proteinuria, who parenthetically doesn't have a high risk of progression, it will take the study didn't show that we were able to impact in 2.6 years that outcome, but it did show a reduction in cardiovascular events. Therefore, if a whole person is in front of you, wouldn't you want to treat the whole person? So that's kind of the nuance that we hope comes across better in a conversation than it does, because no matter how much we tried to wordsmith it, I think that's the point that is really critical for us as people doctors, not just kidney doctors, to really appreciate.
So coming back to that whole risk of like many events over a lifetime, and maybe your kidneys are okay, but you've got heart failure, and how that impacts you as a person and the society as a whole.
So, maybe the data for ACE inhibitors and no proteinuria for progression of kidney disease is similarly not robust. But we give people ACE inhibitors who don't have proteinuria and have kidney disease anyway. So we're trying to say to people, you know what, SGLT2, same thing. In the studies, we weren't able to show delay of progression with low protein because that wasn't in the cards for you in that short time period. However, we did reduce other events, and that might be important to the person in front of you.
Fantastic. And then, as we start to look at other agents like finerenone and the GLP-1 receptor agonists, I know that there are trials of combinations that are starting to be put together, but we won't have that data for a few years. What are your thoughts on where this is gonna land?
You'll know that when you see slides of pillar therapy, you generally see Greek temples with pillars, and the pillars being ACE inhibitors, SGLT2, GLP, one receptor agonists, etc. But we always forget about the base. And I did just want to make the point that we urge the holistic approach to treatment. That begins with the lifestyle stuff, begins with weight reduction, exercise, avoidance of tobacco, blood pressure control, and again, we shouldn't forget about that. We need to get the foundations correct before we start adding in the pillars. Again, as I say, we advocate that very much within the guideline.
Yeah, and I guess from an international perspective, there are places that will never have these medicines. And we know that those lifestyle modifications do impact tremendously. And to your question about the newer agents, well, first of all, the nice thing is it took us 10 years to do the update because there wasn't much in the literature to update. However, it will not take 10 years for the next update because of this, plethora of well-designed, large randomized controlled trials that will change the landscape. I think, again, individualizing therapy. So if you're overweight, maybe the GLP-1s are better. And if you're not, maybe finerenone, maybe a nonsteroidal MRA is better. Like, I think there's going to be nuances and I think it's like not one size fits all. And maybe it's possible that we may become more sophisticated, like oncologists. And maybe there are induction therapies for people with X. And then when you've mitigated their risk, you see if they can actually maintain things with lesser medications. Like it's not clear how we're going to evolve. But I do think it will be these newer agents certainly have a role, the non-steroidals, the GLP-1s, and in various combinations in various fields. The highest risk people should probably be on everything. Lower risk, perhaps you choose which one suits them. And I think as we evolve genetics, we may find that some of these responders, non-responders, are because of genetic things and profiles that would then allow us to truly do precision medicine and not have to treat everybody with 10 tablets, but rather three because we know they work. And so I think that's the exciting future that I might be excited in terms of nephrology.
Sounds great. I wanted to come back to the comment on lifestyle management, and I think there's an interesting section in the guideline about diet and this whole idea of promoting plant protein instead of animal protein, thinking about less processed diets. I mean, can you talk a little bit further maybe about that for us as well?
There's good reason to use a plant-based, less animal-based protein diet that has ideally no processed food in it, but less processed food. And the reason behind that is all about bioavailability of stuff that we stick in our mouths as it travels down our GI tract. So using those sorts of diets helps us control phosphate, helps us control potassium. And actually is associated with better outcomes before you start thinking about how much protein you're taking in. So, and those are the sorts of key things that I think we've kind of forgotten. We get fixated on reinventing the wheel sometimes in medicine in general, but in nephrology in particular. And I'm old. So I was brought up in the era of 20 grams of protein a day. That really isn't good for you. Sorry, but it isn't. And I also took over a unit where people had been managed like that, and it was like going into a concentration camp. I don't want to see that again. Not for my patients anyway.
Yeah, and I guess the other piece that we think is important in the new guideline is also the myth busting about potassium. Can we go back to some physiology, understand potassium properly, and stop being, silly about what we're telling people? And again, the cessation of drugs that impair potassium excretion is your last thing that you do. It's the reduction in processed foods that will give you the best bang for the buck in terms of eating both better nutrition as well as the highest bioavailable potassium is in processed foods, not in tomatoes and oranges and bananas, which we have deprived people of for a long time, which is really sad. And this n knowledge that not only is a plant-based and fiber-based diet good for you in so many respects, as Paul mentions, in terms of phosphate, potassium, bicarbonate, protein load, et cetera, but also maintains GI motility, which is important for absorption of medications, potassium. Like this, it's so interesting. And as we learn more about the gut microbiome interaction with the kidney, like now it makes so much more sense that these people on these better diets, quote, have less progression to kidney disease, less cardiovascular disease, perhaps. This is the inflammasome at work, and this interaction is really important. So, again, going back to basics and also making it accessible to everyone everywhere, because diet is accessible to everyone everywhere. That would also be the other reason for that emphasis.
It's kind of no surprise, really, is it? If you think of machines, a well-oiled, well-maintained machine will go on for years and years and years. And they've known that in the airline industry for donkey's years. And yet we have lots of aspects of ourselves that are not well-oiled and well-maintained. So, and that starts with perioral gum disease and carries on now. I think we're getting there in that. We're beginning to consider all of these things together. And again, that comes back to that holistic approach. For so long, we've been looking for a magic bullet that'll just solve it and we won't have to do anything else. We're beginning to realize that that actually doesn't exist. It's a combination of things.
I think that comment about potassium is, is so important. I feel like, when I hand out the standard dietary guideline to my patients in clinic, I literally say to them, there are a lot of healthy foods here that, I would like to see you eating some of them. So I think that idea of, working around and changing how we advise patients, that's an incredibly important and useful piece. And just segueing on from that, one of the other points that you make is, this risk of discontinuation of ACE inhibitors because of hyperkalemia and the newer data that we are appreciating on that.
Yeah, very much so. There's accumulating data in multiple jurisdictions that demonstrate the cessation or reduction of ACE or ARB therapies or RAS inhibition therapies, usually for hyperkalemia or change in creatinine, leads to worse outcomes. So those people that need them the most are the people in whom they get stopped because people forget their potassium physiology, right? That small changes in plasma K or serum K are do not dysrhythmias make, right? It's this like kind of amazing preoccupation with potassium is greater than 5.5 that is detrimental to our patients. And again, we try and call that out and demonstrate there's many things you can do. And remember, there's a diurnal variation, there's circadian rhythm to potassium, serum and plasma Ks are different. Like all these things that we as nephrologists ought to remember and know, but perhaps have gotten intellectually lazy about thinking through. And so really important to maintain medications that we know are benefit. And with the new and the older MR mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists, it's really important for people to stay on them. They're antifibrotic agents for your heart and for your kidney. So anything you can do to stay on them would be good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Fantastic. And I guess one other question that I think has come up a couple of times in our conversation is this whole question around access and disparities and the global burden of CKD. I think this is one of the bigger challenges that we as a community face. I think we've talked about this a little bit in terms of doing the simple things right and maybe not always reaching for the shiny new drug. But in terms of the disparities, even in diagnosis of CKD, how do you see, you guys have thought about this very deeply in the KDIGO committee. How do you see that being tackled?
So I think, again, it begins with using, first off, using what you have available to you and using it properly, understanding how to use it and understanding how to interpret it. And you can do an awful lot with simple stuff. So you could do an awful lot. Let's say you don't have a laboratory available to you, but you do have point of care testing. Let's say you don't have a fancy CT scanner, but you do have an ancient old ultrasound machine. You can do that at the bedside. You can do quite a lot with simple stuff that you have in front of you already that doesn't need a huge amount of money. If you can do that and you can identify early and you can start to prevent, then you're reducing the number of expensive events further down the line. So you're already beginning to do that. I guess the other thing I'd say is that when we were writing the previous guideline in 2012, we just drew a little graph of resource versus outcome and looked at it in terms of you can have a gold standard treatment, great if you can afford it. You can have silver standard, but there is a minimum that you should be aspiring to. And that's the minimum that gives you the biggest bang for your buck, essentially. So, in finally coming around to answering your question, we need to get at governments and departments of health, or whatever they're called in the various countries around the world, and ensure that kidney health becomes a priority. And that again, that goes right back to our first statement at the beginning of the article, where we were talking about the statement released on World Kidney Day. So, kidney health for all is a trite thing to say, but it's where we should be going.
Everything he said is right. But I think we will not fix the world healthcare problems unless we make even accessible things. I'm sorry if you said this, like think not everyone can even measure creatinine or urine protein or a blood pressure. So perhaps start there. Can you, with point of care testing or simple strips, can you identify kidney disease early in places with very little resources so that you can intervene early? That would be another sobering way to sort of think about this.
Absolutely agree. And people forget that reagent strips for hematuria in particular are actually extremely good, probably far better than your lab these days, because people won't have time to do high power microscopy and count the number of red cells per high power field. They just won't do that. But the stick that was shown, gosh, in the 1980s in the Journal of Urology by one of my colleagues. Curiously, protein not so accurate, but if you're using a strip reader, again, you can get a pretty accurate point of care ACR. So these things are achievable if you understand what you're doing. And I think, again, the key thing is about understanding. I mean, we've been privileged on the two major guidelines that Adira and I have co-chaired to have had a clinical chemist sitting in the group, and he keeps us very grounded with what's achievable in the lab and what isn't achievable in the lab, and what we believe is perfect actually is far from perfect. And I mean, you'll be very aware, Martina, from your colleagues in Boston anyway, who Leslie and Andy, who've espoused that for a long time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I just want to say thank you both for your time. This has been such an interesting conversation. I've learned so much myself, and I think it will be a fantastic backdrop for our audience for the issue, and it'll help guide their reading. Thank you both again for taking the time to chat with me and give us an overview of your editorial. It's been a wonderful conversation.
This podcast is copyrighted by the American Society of Nephrology. All rights reserved. All content in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be medical advice. This podcast should not be used in a medical emergency or for the diagnosis or treatment of any medical condition. Please consult your doctor or other qualified healthcare professional if you have any questions about any medical condition or before taking any drug, changing your diet, or commencing or discontinuing any course of treatment. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the American Society of Nephrology.